Hi guys, I'm back home again. I came to you last week from Melbourne, down here at the bottom of Australia, and I was there doing my two-day workshop, so I would have done day one, which was Thursday. Went and did day two of Friday. So business as usual there, all that went just fine. And then on Saturday, I went to the AppSec Day conference, of which this was part of, and went and saw a couple of talks. Did a talk of my own as well around billions of breached data records, and that went fine. And then I went and had a bunch of beers with people too, which was really neat. So met a lot of really interesting people there as well. So to be honest, that's what is the good thing about these events. It's the hallway conversations and the people you bump into and all the sorts of connections and things that come of that. So yeah, that was really good. Happy with that. Now, of course, while I was down there, a thing happened, which was Equifax. And Equifax is one of the things I sort of really want to talk about today. And I'm going to have a look at some of my notes here, because this was just, oh boy, where do we even begin on this? So, actually, the timing-wise, I did my weekly update. I sort of pressed the stop button, walked out of the hotel, looked at my phone, and I saw, there's another data breach. Another company's been hit. You know, like it's just another day on the internet. And then you start to read about it. And admittedly, I did not know who Equifax was before Friday. I should have, because the penny has since dropped that they actually bought the credit monitoring service in Australia that I use, which has gone through a few name changes over the years. So, all right, I guess I can understand why maybe I didn't realize that immediately. But yeah, that's really great when I go and look at my own credit monitoring service and I see a great big Equifax logo on it. So let's talk about Equifax. And on Saturday, I wrote a piece on my Security Sense column called The Trust Problem with Equifax. Now, much of the premise that I was setting forth then was around the fact that, you know, look, a data breach can happen. And then there are questions about what happens after that, insofar as how does the organization respond, behave, regain consumer trust? And it just looks really, really bad for Equifax. Now, there's another angle as well that I really want to talk about after this, but let's explore this one first. So some of the things that I sort of reference here that looked really bad were things like managers selling shares immediately after the disclosure. Now, actually, let me rephrase that. Managers selling shares very shortly after Equifax learned of the breach. Now, I have seen comments already, and I'm sure we'll see more to this effect, and it may well be true as well, but I've seen comments that went to the effect of these managers did not know about the incident. The trades were made independently. And obviously, the concern that people have here is that if there were trades made when insiders had knowledge of something which would impact the market, you see where I'm going with this. The worst possible scenario there is insider trading kind of lands you in jail. So that is not a good look. I mean, obviously going to jail is not a good look, but the whole thing about trading after that incident had become known by Equifax as an organization is not a good look. And this is sort of the point about it being not a good look. Even if it was independent and it wasn't related, it's not a good look. So this is one of the things that's appearing in the headlines. And you just would have thought an organization of that nature would have seen something like this event, which does have a material impact on the share price. We have seen that certainly take a hit. You kind of think they would have gone, hey, senior managers, so they've got millions of dollars in shares, maybe just don't sell them just for a little while, please. Now, I mean, I don't know how feasible that is in an organization like that, but it just seems like a sensible thing to do. And then there's just a trail of disaster after that. Now, one of the most obvious things is it took about 6 weeks from the point where they knew about the incident to when it was finally disclosed a week ago. And 6 weeks is, what's the right way of putting this? Not exactly industry gold standard. If someone was to ask me, what would you consider to be industry gold standard? I'd say 72 hours, 3 days. And we have seen that in cases. I've spoken about the Red Cross Blood Bank service before, a data breach that I helped to disclose and that I was also included in, and my wife was included in. They took 72 hours. It's not easy doing it in 72 hours, but when a company wants to, it is possible. So 6 weeks, way too long. And I haven't actually seen exactly why it took 6 weeks, but as I say in the piece, you can be sure that it's going to include the words ongoing investigation. They will almost certainly say, look, we were trying to figure out what happened. Now, look, it's a hard thing in terms of how long is long enough, because you got to try and figure out what happened. They're trying to constrain any further damage. They're obviously trying to manage image and all this sort of thing as well, not very successfully. But it's going to take some time, but yeah, 6 weeks, not a good look at all. Anyway, so then they put up the service where you can go and now search for your data. You can go in there and sort of figure out whether you're part of the breach. And they stand it up on this really dodgy looking domain, which is not a subdomain of Equifax.com, doesn't have an EV certificate. And yes, I know I have been very disparaging of EV certificates in the past, but I have also said that it will provide some little benefit to some people. And frankly, the position Equifax are in, they need to be taking everything they can get. So that should have been an absolute no-brainer. So there was that one. The service that was there to search for your data then had all sorts of other problems. So it was returning inconsistent results. It's one of the problems. I believe it was down for a while as well. And having run a data breach service for some time and had some experience with this, I can tell you it's not necessarily easy keeping the whole thing up the whole time either. So that's probably not a big surprise there. They also have reflected XSS, or at least had reflected XSS. In fact, someone contacted me by email just a couple of days ago and said, hey, here's the reflected XSS. And they'd managed to sort of inject in and break out of some try-catch block in JavaScript. Kind of a funky little bit of XSS, but XSS all the same. And the guy that sent it to me was like, yeah, I've been trying to get in touch with them, but they don't return my calls. And all right, of all times to try and get a response from Equifax on security, this is probably a combination of the hardest possible time for them because they're so overloaded, as well as the most critical possible time because everyone is giving them free pen tests at the moment. So you would have thought they'd pick that up. The news picked that up. So Zach Whitaker at ZDNet wrote a piece about it, and everyone pays attention once it's in the media. So there was that, and just all sorts of other little weird idiosyncratic things that is making it look really, really bad. And the latest thing that I've noticed just today, and I shared this only a few hours ago before recording this, was that they are now going to need to appear, and I'm not sure what the correct US legal term is, but basically appear in front of Congress, and the CEO has been summoned to Washington on the 3rd of October, effectively to explain what's going on. And that's not going to be a good day for him. It's going to be very difficult because he's going to have to try and tell the story. Some of the other things, actually, and I don't have notes on this. I'm just sort of rambling on the top of my head, off the top of my head. Stuff like they had an Apache Struts version, which was several months unpatched and some known vulnerability. One report said that was the vector. I've shared, with the caveat of allegedly, a couple of different posts that purport are saying that they are related to the hackers or someone who's spoken to the hackers and has spoken about things like unprotected admin panels, keys floating around. There was a story about an Argentinian interface that had a username of admin and a password of admin. And you just sort of see these patterns of egregiously bad security behavior. And that there's two interesting things I want to talk about as a result of this that weren't in the Security Sense piece I wrote. One of them is, I've said many times before that when you start to see bad security incidents in an organization, or rather bad examples of security, so let's say the reflected XSS, very frequently this becomes part of a pattern related to the overall security culture of the organization. So where we're at now, where we're seeing username admin, password admin, reflected XSS, a site that can't stay up, dodgy looking domains, we're at the position where it is hard not to draw the conclusion that there was just something fundamentally rotten throughout the organization in terms of their security profile. And on that basis, you can only expect that in an organization that size, they're worth $11 billion or something like that, that there's going to be a lot more stuff because it is the pattern. It is the code smell, for want of a better term, that has just infiltrated through a large amount of what they do. Now, this leads me to the second observation, which is I don't think that Equifax is that unusual. I think they just got caught. Now, being cautious about the way I phrase this, I have spent many, many years inside one of the world's largest organizations, many times larger than Equifax. And the number of things I saw in there about the way very sensitive data was handled and the culture of security makes me wonder how they have not been in the news. And mind you, they have been in various regards for very, very minor offences. But when we look at the Equifax thing, where I'm going with this, and it's not just in my previous place of work, but in many other organisations I've seen and that you have probably seen as well, is that many of these egregiously bad security practices are the norm. And to reiterate what I just said before, this happens all the time. The difference is not everyone gets caught. So I think that that's a sort of a really interesting angle out of this. And as much as everyone, after all these events, likes to sort of jump up and go, this might be the watershed moment. You know, like this might be the moment where everyone goes, oh yeah, we should do security. It won't be, because it never is. And it wasn't after Ashley Madison, and it wasn't after Anthem Health and OPM and all these other things that happened. Nothing fundamentally changes afterwards. There are like little incremental things that get a little bit better. And, you know, maybe, for example, after the CloudPets thing, as well as the Kayla doll and that sort of stuff, there's discussions in the US about, you know, we've got to have sort of more guidance and governance around connected toys. And that may happen, and it will be very long and gradual, and it might make a bit of a difference. But this is not going to be a moment where suddenly everything changes and now we actually take it seriously. It just doesn't work that way. So that's Equifax, and that is an unfolding nightmare that I think has a lot of stuff yet to come out. And, you know, over time, one of those things will be, how did this actually happen? And I don't think we really have a good answer on that yet. And it may take some sort of congressional hearing or whatever that construct is to actually understand. All right, that's those guys. Let's move past things that were broken to new things, which is Apple, and in particular iPhone X, and in particular Face ID. So they had their big dog and pony show this week, which, to be honest, I've been pretty excited about. And the reasons why I've been pretty excited about it is that I've had iPhones for, I don't think I had the first or second gen, I think it's about Gen 3. And that has been the one device that I've had, and I've locked myself into the Apple ecosystem, as have Kylie, as have my parents, as have most of my relatives. Everyone has got Apple things because they all play nice to each other and everyone understands what they are. And we've basically bought in. And look, I mean, if they went to shit, I'd change. But for the most part, they're very, very good devices. So I was obviously very interested to see what would come out with this iPhone X. You meant to say X, I think you meant to say 10, aren't you? But every time I see it, I think X, the new iPhone. And I was very keen to see. We've seen lots of leaks and so on over recent times, and we pretty much knew a lot about this new phone before it hit. And I think the main thing we didn't know was how are Apple going to spin it? Excuse me. So what I mean by that is, how are they going to position the loss of the home button? How are they then going to position the replacement for Touch ID being the biometric thumbprint? And of course, what they've come out with is they've said, well, we've got Face ID. And now you just point the phone at your face and you log in. And I find this really interesting for many reasons. And one of the reasons is that I think biometrics in general are really great ways of moving people from a very bad security position to one that is much better. Now, what I mean by very bad security position is that for the most part, people either have no PIN whatsoever, that's especially bad, or they have weak PINs. And when they have PINs, be they weak or strong, they enter them very frequently in front of other people. The kids may know them. It may be the same as they use on the padlock they lock their bike up on, so other people see you there. there are all these opportunities for PINs as a security measure to be compromised. So moving to a model such as biometrics changes things. Now, I don't want to say it's better or worse, because the point I'm trying to make in the blog post I wrote about Face ID, Touch ID, No ID, PINs, and pragmatic security, the point I'm trying to make here is that all of these things are different. Now, here's why I wrote this post. I wasn't planning on doing it. It would have been, where are we? We're Friday to Wednesday morning, my time. So the joy of being in Australia is that when things like this event happen, like I get up hours afterwards and people have already left all their commentary. I sort of got up and I looked at a bit of the commentary and I tweeted something along the lines of, here you go, what did I do? Tell you exactly what I tweeted. I said, Face ID, for 99.x% of people, their threat actors are people who steal their phone at a bar. For everyone else, don't use biometrics. And really what I was sort of trying to say here is that what most people are trying to protect their devices from are opportunistic thieves. That and their kids, which is sometimes the same thing. But the point there is that the risk that most normal people face is an actor who will not be able to circumvent your biometrics. Almost certainly will not be able to circumvent it. Now, whether that's Touch ID or Face ID, if some bloke goes and picks my phone up from a bar on my current phone here I use Touch ID on, they're not getting in there. If the NSA picks it up, they may be able to do the thing with my fingerprint where they lift it off a glass and then they take a photo of it and then they enhance it and they print it onto a PCB board, and then they make like a gummy bear mold and they put that on there and they turn it into a thumb and then they put it on the thing. They would have that capability. Guy in the bar doesn't have that capability. Now, this is putting aside for a moment that the NSA is probably not interested enough in my phone to even bother doing that, but let's just, you know, humour me here for a bit. So this sort of leads to the point of pragmatism. And this blog post has actually resonated really, really well. I think in the last, how long ago did I post it? Less than a day ago, because we're actually going on 2 o'clock here today. I'm a bit late. And I posted this about 7 p.m. last night. I've had somewhere in the order of 30 or 40,000 views of this post, dozens and dozens and dozens of comments. And it's gone down really well, mostly because people have said, this is really practical. Now, what I was trying to do here was address the impractical perceptions of things like biometrics. And what I mean by an impractical perception is I had people telling me things like, look, biometrics is bad because the police can compel you to unlock your phone if it has biometrics, but not if they have a PIN. Now, the first thing is, most people saying this, remember you're in America and there are other countries. Okay, now I say that simply because this is a thing in the US, and I did independently verify that. I'm not sure that it's the same everywhere else, and I'm sure it's very important to many people there. But let's keep in mind that when we start getting to the point of what can police do and not do, this is a very jurisdictionally specific thing. Now, be that as it may, in situations where the police can do that, and it does sound kind of screwy, I imagine it's something like if you were forced to tell someone something, i.e. PIN, it could be self-incriminating, whereas if you were just putting your thumb on something, it's different. Now, I think that's, frankly, a bit of a shitty argument because the same end result occurs in terms of phones. But hey, let's not get into that. So anyway, people are saying, look, biometrics is no good because that can happen. And you're sort of going, all right, but how many people are actually worried about that actually happening? And I don't want this to sound like anti-encryption apologists who go, look, if you've got nothing to hide, it doesn't matter, because it's not that. It is more about what is the likelihood of someone actually getting their hands on your device and then compelling you to unlock it. The thing is as well, when you start to play this logic through, and let's say it's me and I'm going through customs in the US. In fact, I will be doing this on Monday, and don't get any smart ideas from this either, guys. Let me explain. I have my phone. I'm going through customs in the US and they go, we want to inspect your phone because maybe because you do the thing with the data breaches. And I go, well, no, I don't want you to. And they go, well, put your thumb on it. You've got to put your thumb on it. And I go, oh, okay, fine, I'll just put my thumb on it. And what people are saying is that If you had a pin, it wouldn't do that. If asked to turn up after travelling halfway around the world preparing for a big event like next week with a lot of people waiting for me, and they were to say, put your thumb on it, and I go, well, I can do that, but it's got a pin. I don't use Touch ID. And then they said, well, the only way you can come into the country is to enter your pin. I would probably end up entering my pin. Now, I don't like the idea of that. I don't like the feeling of that. But the point is that just this premise of saying, if you have biometrics, you're screwed. If you have a pin, you're fine. It's not going to play out that way. This look the same if the cops did actually put you under duress. There's a lot of people who would ultimately end up entering their pin. Now, frankly, if I thought that that was a likely thing to have happen and I was worried about it, I wouldn't take my phone. Or I would erase my phone and I would take an empty phone, and then I'd get to the hotel, I'd connect to iCloud, restore from backup, job done, we're all good to go. So you see what I mean? Like this, when you actually think it through, things actually start to change. Another good example, people would say, you shouldn't use Touch ID because there was a story about a kid who grabbed their sleeping parent's hand, put it on the home button of the phone, unlocked the phone, went and bought Pokemons. Don't use Touch ID. And I was saying, well, okay, hang on a second. All right. First of all, the kid probably needs a kick up their ass, proverbially speaking. If one of my kids did that, I think the discussion we would be having is very much around trust. Because you trust your family to behave responsibly in your house. Now, whether that is unlocking my phone without my knowledge, going to a PC I leave unlocked, and I don't lock the PC every single time I walk away from it at home. I obviously do in a public place, definitely not at home, because it's behind closed doors and the only people there is my family. If the kids were taking money out of my wallet, we would have the same trust discussion. And that is enormously important. So that's the first thing. But leading on from there and looking at the way sort of Face ID and Touch ID and everything differ, this is one of the cool things about Face ID. So there's no longer the touch component where someone can just grab your hand. You can't point a Face ID iPhone 10 at someone's face and it'll unlock, because there has to be eye contact. This was part of what I mentioned in the blog. Now then people say, okay, what if a thief, well, let's say it's customs. What if customs picks up your phone and then goes, aha, and holds it up to you? And then the thing sees your face and it unlocks. I'm actually curious about that. I don't know if that's possible, but I promise you, the first thing I'll do when the phone lands, I'm going to order it as soon as it comes online next month. First thing I do is I'm going to have a list of shit that I want to try with this phone, and we're just going to try all these things. It's going to be awesome. You know, like, can I do that? Like, I'll get my son just to grab it and point at my face. What happens if he tricks me and he sort of hides the phone behind something else and asks me to look at a picture, but it's actually the phone and it's looking through a hole in the paper? I don't know, but I'm kind of curious. I'm going to test that. And again, we sort of come back to this thing about how likely is this to actually happen and how does it compare to the other models? Now, one of the things that sort of surprised me when I started tweeting about this is there were a couple of schools of thought, a couple of camps, if you like, that got very serious about this. And frankly, some of the responses verged on, at least my perception of the tweets, a little bit aggressive and a little bit inflammatory. And they're around domestic violence and around sort of freedoms and social liberties and everything. Now, the domestic violence one, I still don't understand, but I'll sort of explain the way it was represented to me. Someone was saying, look, this is a real problem for domestic abuse scenarios where, let's say, a husband is beating his wife. You know, this biometrics are a real problem. And I have still not been able to understand this. And in fact, I mentioned in the blog post, and someone whose wife works in domestic violence environments also said, look, I can't actually see how this is really relevant. I think what the original individuals were trying to say is that if a husband is abusive and the wife's phone is using biometrics, then they could maybe force her hand onto the Touch ID or point the phone at her face or something like that. But I can't help but imagine, and keeping in mind I have been neither the attacker or the victim in a domestic environment situation, so I'm only guessing here, But I can't imagine that in a case where there was a really abusive partner that they couldn't also compel the victim to unlock the phone themselves. And in fact, what the guy said in the comment is he said, look, very often in these environments, particularly when there's kids involved, the husband, I assume it's normally the husband, may also be threatening the children. And if a man's there threatening a child and saying, unlock your phone or I'm going to hit the kid, you know, like what? I don't think Touch ID or Face ID change any of that. And what I suspect happened with these tweets is people started talking about a subject that is very emotional. It might have particular relevance to them personally as well. And I felt that sort of distracted from the talk about the technology, because the reality of it is the technology doesn't seem to make any difference in that sort of scenario. I had other people sort of saying, you know, what about, you've got civil liberties. And again, this particularly comes up in the US. Incidentally, if you're in America, remember you're about 4% of the world. So there's actually a lot of other places out there that do things. But obviously there are issues such as the police acting illegally. One of the things that came up, so I said, look, police have been known to plant evidence. Police have been known to delete things off other people's phones. And obviously this was something that was very important to some people. And, you know, one of the examples there was someone saying, well, what about, apparently there was a case where a lady was filming as a guy got shot by the cops. And they said, you know, what if she was only using biometrics and after she filmed the guy getting shot by the cops came over to her, told her to unlock the phone because it's biometrics, they can force her to do that. And then they delete the photo. And I'm saying, all right, first of all, that would be terrible if that happened. Let's not sugarcoat that. Second of all, to line up all of these things together, cops are shooting a bloke, wife is there filming it, not FaceTime, like live, or not FaceTime, but not live streaming it to Facebook or Twitter, but actually filming it to local storage, manages to get that evidence, and then the cops take the phone from her, and it's only got biometrics, and they say you have to unlock it, and they go in there and illegally delete the photo. You are lining up so many highly unlikely events into one sort of narrative. This is highly unlikely to happen. And all of this comes down to things like likelihood. The likelihood of my kids grabbing my hand and putting it on my phone without me waking up and giving them that proverbial kick up the backside is highly unlikely. The whole shooting thing, highly unlikely. The domestic violence situation where someone can be compelled to unlock a phone with biometrics where they wouldn't have been compelled to unlock it with a PIN, highly unlikely. But you gotta compare both models. You can't just look at one in isolation and say, look, a bloke could be beating his wife and force her to put her finger on the home button. You gotta look at the alternative. Look, I find the whole thing really fascinating. And I think this is a really interesting side of security when we start looking at human elements and we look at how they compare to each other. And we don't just look at one thing in isolation and say this is perfect or it's crap, as if there's sort of these two binary positions. But we look at it as it relates to all the other options and we say, and I'm just looking back at my notes again here, but we say things like, look, if you're in a scenario such as you're going to go through let's say customs, and you're worried about your fingerprints being coerced, you know, maybe that's a time where you turn off Touch ID. iOS 11, apparently you can hit the home button or the side button on the iPhone 10. Got it right straight away that time. Hit the side button 5 times and it immediately disables Touch ID until you unlock the phone with a PIN. So, you know, you could always go, hey, look, I'm approaching customs, right? Time to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Good. Now we'll go through, maybe coerced to unlock it anyway if you actually want to get into the country. Anyway, you get the point. Have a read of the post. I enjoyed writing it because it just made me think about things in a very human-centric way. Now, speaking of going through customs, so I, on Monday morning, am heading off to Utah. And Utah is the home of Pluralsight. It's somewhere I've been many times before now. And it's a really cool part of the U.S., for the 96% of you who aren't in America, it's really interesting going to the US because it is so diverse between different states. And someone said to me once, the US is more like sort of 50 different little countries than it is different states. And it is very much like that. So yeah, I find Utah and Salt Lake City to be quite different to much of the rest of the US. And it is a spot I really like. Unfortunately, not going there during snow season because I particularly like it then as well. But I'll be there at Pluralsight Live. So I will be at the Author Summit on Tuesday and then at the live event Wednesday and Thursday. And then Thursday, I have a keynote to do right around the time Michelle Obama does hers as well. So there is my claim to fame. The same stage as Michelle Obama. I would like in my mind to picture us just sort of high-fiving as we come and go. I don't think that's going to happen unless I want to get tackled. But look, it'll be a cool event and it's just gonna be a fun thing. And then I've got Friday off in Salt Lake City. So I'm going to go and meet a bunch of people. I'm going to go and meet Ubiquity as well. Never actually met anyone from Ubiquity face-to-face. And do a couple of other things. So that'll be really cool. I will come to you on next Friday from Salt Lake City. And then last thing, sponsor today is Terbium Labs and their Matchlight product. And Terbium has been on there on the sponsor bar many times before as well. So big thank you to those guys for continuing their support. And I will come back to all of you next week from the US, hopefully with a phone that hasn't had anything done to it on the way in. But I might just turn off Touch ID just in case. See you guys.